Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be joined by our next guest to talk about Pope Benedict XVI, who was already a towering figure in Catholic theology long before he became Pope, long before he became an important Vatican figure of any kind. He was making tremendous contributions, and his contributions are really incomparable. But what are the ideas that hold his theology together? What unifies his life and his work? We're going to talk about Pope Benedict XVI this hour, and you are welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Dr. Richard DeClue. He's professor of theology at the Word on Fire Institute. He's got a new book out, came out on Benedict XVI's birthday, April 16th of this year, The Mind of Benedict XVI. In the book, he provides an overview of Benedict's life and work. Dr. DeClue, thank you very much for being here with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I'm going to try to do a really good job because Al Cresta, we were talking about last hour, who recently passed, was such a good interviewer when it came to books that now I feel like I got to pick up my game. I mean, if everyone's remembering Al Cresta, I'm going to have to. So I just want you to know, if I don't do a good job, it's not for lack of trying this hour. For once, I'm not going to mail it in. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. If you have questions about the life and thought of Benedict XVI, Joseph Ratzinger, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. So maybe I will start right there at the beginning with the question that I just expressed about, is there a unifying theme in his work?
I believe so, and that's why I subtitled the book A Theology of Communion, because I think that the notion of communion is really the leitmotif that links all the different areas of his thought together. And so throughout the book, what I try to do is show how these different areas that he worked on are all connected through that one theme of communion, and therefore they all relate back to that theme of communion in one way or another. And therefore, you can see all these different interconnections between the themes.
Wasn't he one of the founders of Communio, the journal, the theological journal?
Yes, absolutely.
And so, in a certain way, though, it's for a Catholic, you go, well, communion, that's kind of the through line of the whole Catholic thing. So what's special about the way he thought about communion?
Yeah, I think one of the ways that I appreciate how he tackles it is precisely the degree to which he links it with the triune God, which obviously is not unique to him, but I think the throughout his thought, he's able to show how every area of theology is truly about God. So even when we're talking about the church or the sacraments or the moral life or eschatology, it still is somehow connected to God as the central object of study, the central object that we're speaking about. And it's because God is triune, because God is a communion, everything else in theology receives from the triune God this communal dimension.
Well, you're going to have to correct me if my recollections of his life or my impressions of his life are wrong, but he actually was quite critical of the life of the church in the 1950s, before the Second Vatican Council. Is that because he thought that it was missing God? It was missing this communion between God and man?
He was critical of what he perceived to be a facade, where the people in the pews were being allowed to believe that they were Catholic when in fact they were pagans.
That's an extraordinary sentence right there.
Well, I think it was in 1958, he wrote that article in Hochland where he says, depending on how you translate the German, it's either the new pagans in the church or the new heathens in the church. And he basically says a lot of our people in the pews think that they're really Christian when not. They're not. They're actually pagan.
Okay, so what
and
was...
And we're allowing them to continue to think that because we're not pointing out this fact to them. We're continuing to baptize, basically just dispensing sacraments to anyone who asks for them without really expecting that they're going to be committed to the church and to the faith afterwards. And he thought that that was a grave problem. He thought that in many ways the church had become a cultural facade, that people were Catholic culturally speaking, but that they really didn't have authentic Catholic faith. And he thought that that was a big danger that needed to be addressed.
That kind of proved, I think that proved to be prophetic, or maybe at least have to have foresight in it. So then he, I think what a lot of people know about him, frankly, is that he said the church was going to get smaller. Like, do you know that quote that I'm talking about? Like, a lot of people will tell you, well, like, you know, Benedict said, or Ratzinger said. What was that all about?
I think he was just giving his best prognosis for what he saw happening, mm-hmm. because he saw a culture increasingly moving away from the church, being more hostile to the faith, and more people leaving the faith, and fewer people even within the church being truly of the faith and being somewhat nominally Catholic. And I think his conclusion was, well, then it's probably going to continue to decline in numbers, but perhaps also grow in faithfulness.
Of that facade had to come down, in other words.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be a smaller but purer church, that the people that are there will actually be believers. I think it was just something he was sort of predicting.
Yeah.
This is probably where we're headed, that eventually the persecutions will get too strong, where people will no longer even be willing to maintain the appearance of being Catholic. They will just abandon the title altogether, and those who remain will probably be more actually dedicated to the faith and not just playing a role.
Dr. Richard DeClue is our guest. He's professor of theology at the Word on Fire Institute. His new book is The Mind of Benedict the 16th. It's really extraordinary, the range, the wide range of people who would cite Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict the 16th, as formative on their thought. It's really something to see. However, the word conservative is just like connected to him, like Eeyore's tail, by everyone in secular media. Was he a conservative?
I would say, broadly speaking, yes. It's an interesting phenomenon we have with terminology, because without him really changing his fundamental positions over the years, the view of where he stood on the spectrum changed. It's like everything moved around him in a way. So during the council, he may have been considered a little bit less conservative, or mainly just because he wasn't really a neo-scholastic. He was more interested in the fathers and in St. Bonaventure than he was the Thomistic commentatorial tradition. So because that was the dominant theology at the time, he wasn't sort of a part of that Roman school approach to theology. But even then, he wasn't a liberal progressive. So he was never a liberal progressive, even if some people may have somewhat viewed him that way because of his resistance to neo-scholasticism.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to take our first break, and I'm going to come back, and I want to ask you about that, because this is something that I think you have to understand. Almost an intellectual history of the Catholic Church to understand what that's all about. And I don't have the chops to understand that. And I wish you would help me understand that, about what resourcement meant in the 1960s, what it meant to go back to the sources, why Joseph Ratzinger is considered more of an Augustinian than a Thomist. What was happening? What is the meaning of all of that? Because I can say the words, but I don't know the meaning of it. If you could help me with that when we come back. As I said, Dr. Richard DeClue, our guest, we're talking about The Mind of Benedict the 16th, his new book. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
What do you do on Sundays? You go to church? No, I golf. Ever make a hole in one? No. Well, why don't you pray a little bit? Pray? Yeah, pray. Oh, why I need to pray? I could give you 50 reasons.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back. Cavagance is live. I want to get as deeply as we can in a reasonable way into the theology of Joseph Ratzinger, later Benedict XVI, later Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, and then back to Pope, because you're not Pope Emeritus anymore once you pass from this life into eternity. So we'll talk about his thought, what it means, what we can gain from exposure to it, what we should take away as the things he wanted us to meditate on, the things that he wanted us to have in our soul. You're welcome to call if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, 888-318-7884. I will recommend to you again the book, The Mind of Benedict XVI, by our guest, Dr. Richard DeClue. All right, something's going on in the middle of the 20th century as far as theology. I don't know if I have to go back to the Council of Trent. I don't know if I have to go back to the Scholastics themselves. I don't know. But there's something. The Church is unsatisfied with where it has gotten liturgically and theologically, and Joseph Ratzinger at the time is part of a reexamining of all that theology. Can you just explain that context with me, and please oversimplify?
I'll see what I can do.
Okay.
It is very complex. You had the modernist crisis, which took place it goes back to just modern philosophy, even back to like the 17th century, maybe even earlier. Of course, you had the Protestant Reformation as well. And the advent of modern philosophy, which tended to reject scholastic metaphysics and philosophy and epistemology, it led to sort of a disintegration in Catholic higher education. And so there was a push to try to go back to the great Christian philosophers of the past, especially St. Thomas Aquinas, as sort of a touchstone to try to reintegrate Christian philosophy. And this is an important point. That ended up leading to, after the modernist crisis in the 19th and early 20th centuries, this tendency to react against certain elements that were highlighted by modern philosophy, but in a more, what one could argue would be an overly restrictive manner. So just to be overly simplistic, Hegel had his notion of history, right? So in this context, in the early 20th century, if you mention history and the importance of history, you get,
are you suspicion a Hegelian of being a Marxist? Hegelian, yeah, okay.
Because you had the modernists like Alfred Loisy and others that were pushing these notions of the subjective character of faith, but they were pushing it in a very wrong direction, like almost reducing faith to the subjective sentiment rather than having attachment to an objective revealed truth. Well, then if you started talking about subjectivity in faith and the subjective aspect of it, well, then you're a modernist,
yeah,
right? So
yeah.
When in reality, it's not metaphysics or history, it's both. It's not objective or subjective, it's both. And so one of the issues that at least the resource mom people thought was that Catholic theology was being overly reduced to one commentatorial tradition within the church's patrimony.
Okay.
So it was basically Catholic theology was almost being equated with commentators on St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
And was forgetting a lot of its broader and deeper patrimony. And so what res source mont means return to the sources, is that, well, we really need to be going back and really engaging directly with sacred scripture and with the church fathers themselves, and using that as fuel for our speculative and systematic theology. That systematic theology shouldn't just be deducing further truths from first principles, but should be incorporating more of the thought of the fathers and the scriptures directly, and not just tangentially or in a derivative manner.
I think I got this. I see where you go. So let me oversimplify your oversimplification then. Modern philosophy is in some degree reacting against Catholic medieval philosophy. And then some people came along and said, well, let's broaden out the whole Catholic picture by going back before this whole controversy to people like Augustine.
Yeah, kind of. The part of the issue was that there are a lot of different people involved in these, and some of them were more amenable to modern philosophy than others.
Okay.
You get this mix of people that don't always see eye to eye on the philosophy aspect. But generally speaking, the Ressourcement movement was highlighting the need to go back to scriptures, the fathers, and the high scholastics. And they were pretty much saying that they had no interest in dealing with the commentators. Like, they weren't really interested in what Cajetan mm-hmm. or Suarez had to say as much. Uh-huh. Because they thought that they were leading theology into a dry, self-enclosed, boring fashion that really wasn't up to the task of reaching modern man.
Yeah, and that's what Benedict wanted to do, was reach modern man.
Right. And for a lot of them, it just had to do with their own experience in the classroom. They were just like, this is just not moving me at all. This seems to be, if this is theology, that's kind of sad. Like, who's this going to convince? Because it became almost like a geometric it was like a form of mathematics or calculus, where it was like, well, we're just doing these formulas and creating these like deductive reasoning charts, and we're conclusions upon conclusions upon conclusions about the most minute of theological conclusions. But in a manner that seemed to lack a certain fullness of human depth, like the head and the heart, not just logic, but also the connaturality of knowing God through sapiential wisdom that comes through a life immersed in prayers and mysticism. And that, you know, the form of theology we see expressed in the church fathers, which was much more, it wasn't just a series of logical deductions. It very much was a returning, a look at the sources and reflecting upon those and using even emotive rhetoric sometimes in the proclamation of the theology as a means of moving people.
888-318-7884 is the number. Dr. Richard DeClue is here to talk about his book, The Mind of Benedict the 16th. And I don't want to just put you in a cul-de-sac. I do appreciate you helping me to understand what the kind of context of Benedict's theology is and why he's kind of sort of on the opening up side early in his career, and then he's on more of the let's be clear about what we're doing side on the end of his career. But that's because it's obvious that from the Catholic 1950s to the Catholic 2000s, there's a radical change in how the church talks about almost everything.
Yeah, and you know, there's one line that he has that he wrote very early on, and it's basically his observation was that he thought that post-Tridentine theology, meaning theology after Trent, often had become more counter-reformational than Catholic.
Yeah.
Meaning it was sort of reacting against something and therefore presenting theology intentionally and almost neurotically in reaction to the errors of others, rather than presenting Catholic theology positively on its own terms. And as a result, he thinks it forgot some of its own past and some of the breadth of the tradition that was there.
Is some of that past that the church forgot the person of Jesus Christ at the center of everything? That is, in some ways, other things became so central that we didn't have Christ in our heart and on our lips. We had other things in our heart and on our lips.
I think that could be on a pastoral level. That very much could have been the case. Theologically, which is the area he's mostly dealing with, but he is concerned about the pastoral dimensions, of course. That's why he wrote that article. I would argue that even the neo-scholastics still had a very Christocentric theology.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, Christ is sort of the key to the Summa. So I don't think they lost that per se. But it was the restriction of theology sort of to this one series of commentators, like this trajectory of one line of thinkers throughout the last few centuries.
So then what is his theology of communion? Because you say communion is the through line in his work. What is his theology of communion?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to make one quick caveat, I think it's important to realize that a lot of the Ressourcement folks were not saying that the neo-scholastics were wrong.
Yeah.
They were saying, well, but you're kind of incomplete, or you're not the only way to do this.
Okay.
That there are other ways of doing theology. And not even that they should go away, but that they shouldn't be the only game in town. But as far as this theology of communion goes, again, as I argue, this is something that really struck me in studying his thought, because it seems so obvious in hindsight, but it's not something I had ever thought of before. You know, we talk about how God is knowable through reason alone, right? Unaided human reason, that you don't need revelation to know that God exists, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we often point to people like Plato and Aristotle and give them a lot of credit for coming to that conclusion from a purely natural reason perspective.
Right.
Okay, a lot of our best metaphysics is based on Aristotle, Aristotelian metaphysics, so his understanding of being, essences and existence and those sorts of things. And that is directly tied to philosophy of God, right, what you can know about God. Well, Ratzinger points out, though, that obviously Aristotle could not know that God was triune. And insofar as he did not have that knowledge, his understanding of God and God, and as a result, the categories of being, the hierarchy of the categories of being. So you have like 10 categories, substance being at the top. Right. Well, relation ends up being relatively low on the metaphysical totem pole in Aristotle.
Yeah. Right. I see. Yeah.
Because relation is merely sort of an after effect that results from the finitude of created beings.
Right.
Right. So relation is seen as like one of the weakest forms of being.
Oh, yeah. And you can see how the Trinity totally turns that the other way.
Right. So Ratzinger is the first one that made me realize, I'm not saying there aren't others, but he's the first one that made me realize how important that is, because he basically says, we know from the dogma of the Trinity that relation stands alongside substance as an equally primordial form of being.
That is really something.
Along with divine unity, oneness, the communal aspect, the relationality within the persons of the Trinity, means that being itself in its highest form is relational. And it's not, relation is not something that's just a result of finitude. It's actually part of infinite being itself. And therefore, that changes your understanding of metaphysics.
Yeah.
So that just blew my mind.
You can see how that, but I hate to say you have this, that is a magnificent insight, extremely helpful insight. But what does it, I mean, I hate to turn immediately to the practical, but what's the practical implication of that, that being is relational at its highest level?
Right. So basically what it means is that since God is the key to understanding everything else, right, why does creation exist? Well, creation exists because God wanted to bring creation into communion with himself, to give finite created beings a participation in his life in some way, particularly, you know, rational creature, intellectual creatures, spiritual creatures, angels and humans, right? He wanted to give them this capacity to know and love him and therefore enter into relation with him and share in this divine life, which is communal.
All right, you heard the music, so we got to take a very quick break. We'll come back, and we're going to continue talking about the really exciting mind of Benedict XVI. Dr. Richard DeClue is our guest. The book is The Mind of Benedict XVI. Right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns to the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Join special guests Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and an all-star lineup of speakers September 26th through 29th. Spend time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and our special guests right here in beautiful San Diego. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
On the next More to Life, we remember Al Cresta.
We continue with our reflection on the life and legacy of our dear friend, Al Cresta.
That's on the next More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And we're talking about Pope Benedict XVI. If you have questions about the life and the thought of Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. It's an almost shockingly fertile mind over the course of decades and decades in the church, and then right up to the highest levels of the church, a mind to engage with. And that's exactly what our guest, Dr. Richard DeClue, does in his new book, The Mind of Benedict XVI. The number is 888-318-7884. And whatever your question is, whether it's at the introductory level or at the grad school level, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If it's at the grad school level, I will take a brief nap while the two of you talk. But anybody is welcome to call with their question. We're talking about this idea of communion before we went to the break, that communion is, in your studies of Benedict XVI, and I think you wrote your own dissertation on the thought of Benedict XVI, right? Is that correct?
I did, his theology of divine revelation. Yeah.
That word communion is the one that you see as the if you have to give a one word a unifier for his thought and his life, it's communion. And it was interesting to me where you started with that you went to this idea that the revelation of the Trinity changes our idea of the nature of God, the nature of reality, so radically because it makes relation at the top of the list, not at the bottom of the list of things we have to talk about when we talk about the divine nature, when we talk about being. So what does that have to do with communion?
Right. Well, it means that insofar as humanity is made in the image and likeness of God, part of what that means is that we are communal beings, that persons are necessarily related beings. Because in the Trinity, person means relation and nothing besides, as Ratzinger says. So the basic idea is that we don't just image God solely by the fact that we have an intellect and a will. That's part of it. But precisely insofar as we are meant to live in relation, we're meant to live by, with, and for that the divine persons of the Trinity manifest. So the notion there is then that the whole reason that humans were created was to be brought into communion with God, and thus, by our communion with God, to be brought into communion with one another.
Yes.
So this gives us the key to understanding theological anthropology and how we're not just individualistic beings. So radical individualism is contrary to human nature, which is rooted in the Imago Dei. So there's a communal aspect to even human existence. Now, what does sin do? Well, fall and the sin separate. It separates us from God. It separates us from one another, creates divisions within humanity. And it even creates a lack of integrity, a lack of integral unity within ourselves, right? The war between the flesh and the spirit, between knowing what I should do and not doing it. You know, that internal rift that we find in ourselves because of the results of sin. So what that means is that redemption and salvation are going to reestablish the communion that was lost as a result of sin. It's going to reestablish communion with God, with one another, and even give us integrity back within our very selves. And so what this also means, which is very important, is that the church, therefore, is not merely accidental to salvation.
Oh.
Because the church is really the first fruits of redemption, because it's bringing into communion divided humanity. That's why Vatican II says that the church is like a sacrament or sign and instrument of a very closely knit union with God and of the unity of the whole human race.
Yes.
So the church, in a sense, is the first fruits of the redemptive act of Christ,
yeah,
bringing back divided humanity together as one.
So in his life, he was very respectful of Protestant people, Protestant thinkers. He was very respectful of secular people, secular thinkers. But he is proposing Catholicism as the cure to Protestant and modernist individualism.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because the notion that people are completely independent creatures is, he thinks, a lie. And that's why he thinks the elevation of individual liberty as the highest value is really due. It's an attempt to become like God, but based on a complete idol, because it's a false understanding of God. And so this attempt to become this completely free, liberated, unattached, unhindered individual entity that can do whatever I want is actually a demonic parody of true divine imagery.
Is this
that freedom?
No, please finish. I didn't go ahead.
Yeah, that true freedom is attached to truth, which includes the metaphysical truth of our being, which is to live in right relationship with God and others.
And the church is the, as you said, that's the first breaking in of that in actual human history. Here it is. Is this part of his Regensburg dialogue, which seemed to me he got in trouble because people thought he was insulting Islam, but he was just as much what he was trying to have a dialogue with was secular Europe, it seems to me, in that, and that secular Europe didn't want to think about the fact that he was criticizing them. So they said, well, this is an anti-Muslim thing. But it does seem to me that this idea of relation and communion is a good deal of what he was trying to say at Regensburg.
Yeah, and this notion of truth, I think, is really key for Regensburg, because what he's saying is that contrary to the popular atheist narrative that somehow people of faith are the ones that lack reason, he was arguing, no, we're actually the ones that have a higher evaluation of reason because we believe human reason can know more than you do.
Yeah.
Because you reduce reason to nothing more than knowledge of empirical scientific experimental research or mathematics. Like, and you've reduced knowledge to that sphere alone. And you're missing the fact that the human mind is capable of grasping much deeper and higher truths. And he's saying we need to reestablish reason. And because they're reducing knowledge to just brute scientific facts, then that means they're denying the ability to know truths about morality or truths about, value judgments, for instance. And what that means is you end up with moral relativism, which says there is no moral truth, which means it really is just will to power. It's what can I get away with? And his whole point is, no, you guys are – you're being unreasonable. And he basically says what – If values are not objective and they're not based on a transcendent reality, then by what reason do you have the right to proclaim that individual liberty is the highest good anyway? You've already denied that there is such a thing as objective good.
Yeah.
So what you've done is separated freedom from truth, liberty from truth, action from truth, and therefore you've completely destroyed any attempt at having a reasonably peaceful society at all, because there's literally no basis for it.
Would it be fair to say that they've also separated the idea of justice from the common good, so that justice only refers to do I get to be the person I want to be, not do we get to be the society we want to be?
Yeah, he calls it a proliferation of rights without responsibilities, basically, and thinks it's just completely misunderstanding what human freedom is for.
What did he mean by the dictatorship of relativism?
That because of this scientific reductionism, that we were living in an age that was more and more apt to say that moral truths were not really knowable and that they were really just opinions and not rooted in any real truth. Now, I think he would also argue that most people who say that they're moral relativists really aren't, because if you press them, they'll end up having to admit that they think certain things are objectively wrong.
Yeah.
So he thinks in some ways they're just fooling themselves, but that's what he meant, because it was starting to dominate all discussions. And if there is no real moral order, so if you're going to allow moral relativism to become the primary moral reasoning of a society, especially a society that now has more technological power than it ever has, so you've got an increase in technological power and a reduction in moral reasoning, that's a recipe for disaster. Because now you can do a lot more horrific things, create a lot more immoral destruction, and your ability to even notice that has now tanked. So you're creating a real dictatorship that can do real harm.
And that I imagine that he would apply that. I mean, he passed before the whole transgender thing became the thing of the moment. And there's always a thing of the moment, which seems to be that seems to be one of the sickest features of our society. There's always some moral crusade going on that's detached from reality in most cases. But that's what he's talking about, is you can harm children, you can harm teenagers, you can do all this physical destruction and not even see that you're doing anything wrong.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because it sort of shows you the double mind and forked tongue of modern society.
Yeah.
because they claim to be committed to science, scientific fact. And then in the next breath, they say the most contradictory things, things that go completely against science. You know, biological facts now become meaningless if I want them to be meaningless, right? It shows the domination of the will over metaphysics, over reality. And that's what he's talking about. It's like this is really just the satanic non serviam. I will not serve. You know, my will is supreme. Whatever I want is what I'm going to get, even if it spits in the face of fact. And that's what we're seeing. It's like this weird, on the one hand, we proclaim to be a scientific culture. And on the other hand, we completely deny science. And if you try to point out the scientific facts about these questions, then you're the bigot. You're the one who needs to be silenced and maybe lose your job. It's absolute insanity.
It is indeed. And he saw it coming. He saw it coming as far back as the 1950s, as you said, when he wrote about the rise of paganism, and not paganism outside of the church, paganism within the church. We'll continue our conversation with our guests, talking about just one of the greatest people, I think, of the last 100 years. Just, great and good, both of those things. That is Benedict XVI. The book is called The Mind of Benedict XVI. Our guest is the author of that book and professor of theology at the Word on Fire Institute, Dr. Richard DeClue. The number, if you want to talk to him, 888-318-7884.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is Encouragement Conquers All. Justin Fatica interviews experts in encouragement from all walks of life and share how they give and receive encouragement. You can hear Encouragement Conquers All and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Richard DeClue, our guest. Professor of Theology at the Word on Fire Institute, and the new book is called The Mind of Benedict XVI. What an extraordinary mind. You know what? I think I'll get a caller on with you real quick. We'll do a call, and then we'll come back to more conversation about the book. But Lewis is in Missouri watching on YouTube, and he's been waiting a while, and I apologize for that. Lewis, you have a question for our guest?
Hey, no worries about the wait. My question was the fact that If the Orthodox Church has valid sacraments, and therefore they have valid Eucharist, but if schism is a mortal sin, does that mean each time you take the Eucharist in a schismatic sect, whether it be Orthodox or Catholic schismatic groups, does that mean you're taking it under a state of mortal sin? And if that's the case, does that mean the Catholic Church, by saying they have valid sacraments and that they should take it, are they telling them to take it under a state of mortal sin?
I would say it's a little bit more complex than that. So the act of schism would involve being Catholic and then leaving the church knowingly and willingly. So if you're born outside of the Catholic Church into another church or ecclesial community, it's not necessarily clear that you could be charged with the sin of schism directly. Now, if you knew the Catholic Church was established by Christ as the necessary means of salvation and refused to enter, then you would be guilty for not entering, but being born into a state lacking full communion is not necessarily your fault. So now when you're talking about, it's somewhat of a, you know, misnomer to talk about Catholic schismatic groups, but if you understand it as that to mean people who purport to be Catholic but are in fact schismatic, you have to in moral theology make the distinction between the objectively grave sin and being guilty of mortal sin, because mortal sin involves the three elements: the gravity of the act and the full knowledge and deliberate consent. So we can talk about the objective character of it, and that's something that even Pope Benedict would acknowledge, is that he actually says that the Eucharist is basically the one Christ, and therefore it must be celebrated with the one church or is not being celebrated at all. Now, it's a little bit hyperbolic to say that, but he does think that if you are celebrating the Holy Eucharist apart from universal Catholic communion, there is something inherently defective in it, because it's not corresponding to the reality for which the Eucharist was actually made or was instituted. So we can say there's an objective deficiency there. You can't necessarily say that someone who was born and raised Orthodox in Eastern Europe is committing an intentional sin. Does that help?
Oh, hey, I'm sorry, Lewis, I put you on hold. Does that help you?
Yeah, I think so. I would just follow it up with, if that's the case, that they aren't knowingly in schism, or they aren't knowingly in mortal sin because they were born into schism. I mean, I guess you could take communion in that sense, but then what's the point of calling them schismatic if it doesn't have any actual binding thing on it?
Well, for one thing, church law can only govern her own subjects. Canon law does not apply to non-Catholics in general. So the binding part of it is the objective truth that having the Eucharist apart from full ecclesial communion with the Catholic Church is a defective situation. And therefore, you should want to join her because you have an appreciation for the Eucharist.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Lewis, thank you very much. We'll get to another caller shortly here, but I want to ask you, I don't want to have you here to talk about Benedict without asking about his, and I don't know how it's related to the central theme of communion, but one of the things I think many, many people appreciated about him was his ability to take all, to do Bible scholarship, and to take all of the contemporary Bible scholarship, to take it for what it is, to not be rejecting scholarship out of hand because it doesn't, you know, it's not Catholic scholarship, or it might not even be Christian scholarship, but also to reproduce what that scholarship has given for us in books like Jesus of Nazareth in a fully Catholic way. So could you say something about his project as far as biblical studies goes?
Yeah, this is actually a very important point, because by training, he's a dogmatic and fundamental theologian, not a biblical scholar.
Right.
Yet, and this is something even Protestants have lauded him for, is that his capacity and knowledge of scriptures and the contemporary exegesis was second to none. And the fact that he was able to so masterfully move and use biblical exegesis for his dogmatic and fundamental theology, they just really admired that. And that's not something that's very common. A lot of dogmatic theologians, such as myself, are not necessarily that good at that aspect of theology, but that's precisely because he lived out that commitment to ressourcement we talked about. He didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk. Like, he actually did go back to the sources. And you're right. I mean, his ability to sort of synthesize these centuries of of reflections upon the scriptures from the church fathers through the Middle Ages up to contemporary times, and take the good that he saw in you know, historical critical exegesis while criticizing historical criticism for and pointing out its inherent limitations and calling for a retrieval of like the fourfold sense of scripture from the patristic medieval era, and also calling for the analogy of faith to be an important aspect of biblical exegesis. You know, he really did get to the root of the method itself. And by employing the method he advocated for, it almost proved that he was right about the method, because the fruits that came from that were so great.
Indeed, indeed. I do want to get a caller on here with you. Rich is in Cincinnati, Ohio. Rich, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Dr. Richard DeClue.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to get your thoughts on Pope Benedict's encyclical, Saved in Hope, specifically the section on purgatory. Seems like a lot of modern apologists are still a lot of focus on the temporal punishment due. And when I read that couple of pages there in Saved in Hope, it seemed like Pope Benedict was mostly focusing on, or maybe exclusively focusing on, the whole purification of the soul and, you know, the conversion required before we could enter heaven, and very little focus on the temporal punishment. So did I miss something in there, or did I interpret that correctly?
No, I think you're right. I think the focus would be more on the purification aspect in his thought. However, I think there's probably, my suspicion is that there's actually a way of reconciling those two things. Because part of the temporal punishments means you're talking about the what is needed to restore complete justice to the soul, which is an ontological reality, which is a purification. So even the temporal punishments are a means of getting your soul to be just more just, to be more righteous. So it's a form of purification through those things. So what I would say is the temporal punishments are a means to the ends of purifying our souls, or might even be considered part of that, an integral part of that whole process of purgation. So they're not really two separate things. It could be considered to be what sort of terminology you're focusing on. But I would say the purification, as the name purgatory suggests, is the fundamental reality taking place, and temporal punishments then would be seen as an aspect of that process.
Okay, Rich?
Okay, makes sense.
It does. That I think a lot of people have commented on that in that encyclical. He raises the possibility that purgatory itself is just an aspect of the encounter with the person of Christ. Is that novel that he did that? That he talked in that way?
I don't think that's completely novel. I think there's some, especially there might even be some mystics that talk that way. But It's the notion that the encounter with Christ is, that in some sense, Christ is the purifying fire.
Yeah.
And he's the one that is conforming us more like himself. And so he's the one that's actually purifying us.
Our guest is Dr. Richard DeClue. The book from the Word on Fire Institute is The Mind of Benedict the 16th. You can get it wherever you get your books, certainly wherever you get your good Catholic books. Just ask for it. The Mind of Benedict the 16th from Word on Fire Institute. Dr. DeClue, I'm very grateful for the time that you came to spend with us. If somebody said to you, where should I start with Benedict? Is there a book I should read first? Is that possible or no?
Well, other than mine,
yes.
I honestly tell people they should start with Milestones, which is his own autobiography, because you see how his later thought is already prefigured in his early childhood.
In that,
and I cover that in my first chapter too.
All right. You feel like you have an hour with an expert on Benedict XVI and you can barely scratch the surface. It really is an extraordinary life and mind, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I hope lots of people will get your book. Thanks for holding it up like a professional. But that's how the professionals do it. You hold the book up when you say the name. The Mind of Benedict XVI is the book. You know what? A lot of you forgot to get your father a Father's Day gift. So here, when you show up next time, have this book and you'll have a gift. Dr. Richard DeClue is the author. That does it for us. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.